Good morning. It's good to be with you this morning. Kleber's a new colleague of mine. I'm not from the St. Louis area or the bi-state area. I'm from Atlanta, Georgia. I've lived there for over 30 years. I'm not originally from Atlanta, but few people are, I have discovered over the years. So I am here new in the Midwest and new to this terrain and the people and all of that. I've never spent any time in the Midwest. I hear Chicago doesn't count, so. But I enjoy serving Elliott Chapel very much. I started there in August as the Minister of Pastoral Care. It's in downtown Kirkwood. I'm sure some of you are probably familiar with that area. And it's a wonderful congregation and a wonderful community. And I live only a couple of blocks away from the church in a little apartment that's really close to the train tracks. But it's a little one-bedroom apartment. My partner of 17 years, Gail, and our two dogs, Lucy and Leo, are still in Atlanta in our house. So even though I miss them, I like my little apartment. It's, for the most part, it's quiet when the train's not going by. And it's a great place for solitude and just a little quiet refuge. And one of my favorite times in that apartment, actually, is early in the morning, around 6:30 a.m. That's usually when I start my day. And I begin with a simple breakfast, grape nuts usually, some sort of cereal like that. And of course, I read the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. And the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, like the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, is getting thinner and thinner. So it's a fast read in the morning. A few months ago, however, my usually quiet ritual of cereal eating and paper reading was getting something of a jolt. I wasn't jolted by the dramatic news headlines, although there's plenty going on right now in St. Louis and in our nation with the election and around the world that's disturbing as well as exciting. But rather, as I've been opening the A section of the paper, I was encountering daily a two-page ad featuring a really large photograph of Robin Leach. Now, if you don't recall, Robin Leach was the British host of the 1980s television show Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. And it was a show that gave viewers a glimpse into the exclusive and extravagant lives of wealthy people just like you and me, entertainers, business moguls, athletes, just like us. And Leach used to end his program every week with this sort of hedonistic benediction to his viewers that they have champagne wishes and caviar dreams. Well, Robin Leach was showing up each day in my morning paper, photograph of him with a champagne glass in his hand, little twinkle in his eye, smiling at me. And in bold type over his head was this headline that read, "Sell your gold and silver and get a taste of the good life." Really? Is that all I need to do is hawk my watch and get out my grandma's silver tea set and sell it to Robin and the company that he claims will change my life? Well, of course I'm not fooled, and I'm sure you're not either. But seeing that giant advertisement and Robin's toothy grin each morning got me thinking, what is the good life anyway? If it's not luxurious homes and fast cars and cruises around the world, like many of us know that it's not, then what is it? If millions of dollars and this fit physique aren't required for a blissful existence, is there some baseline of wealth and health that must be attained to be on the path to happiness? Well, as Unitarian Universalists, we're called to consider what it means to live lives mindful of others, other people, as well as other animals, of all existence. We're a faith community that affirms the inherent worth and dignity of every person, regardless of age, ethnicity, sexual orientation, religious background, gender expression. We're a faith community that understands the importance of respecting the interdependent web of all existence. We know we're connected to every person, every plant, every animal, every element on this planet. And we also know that disrupting this interdependency, or worse, acting as if it doesn't exist, has had and will continue to have dire consequences for us all. So, when we consider what it means to have the good life, it seems that we need to first think of our individual lives in relation to all lives. I must understand that my pursuit of the good life has positive and negative consequences on your ability to pursue the good life. Perhaps Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King put it best when he argued that no person or nation can achieve health, wealth, or other things that many of us associate with the good life if others are still suffering. He wrote, "As long as there is poverty in the world, I can never be rich, even if I have $1 billion. As long as diseases are rampant and millions of people in this world cannot expect to live more than 28 or 30 years, I can never be totally healthy, even if I just got a good checkup at the Mayo Clinic. I can never be what I ought to be until you are what you ought to be. This is the way our world is made." King is saying something about the good life that I think some of our business and government leaders perhaps have forgotten. I think they've forgotten it when they lament the loss of American jobs, American wealth, and American global power. They seem to have forgotten that our former way of life, our so-called good life, was achieved at often a terrible cost to many others. Our good life here in the U.S. got its start on the backs of African slaves, some 4 million people at the start of the Civil War, whose labor produced cotton and tobacco for export. This good life continued to be built by hundreds of thousands of poor immigrants and children who worked in mines, mills, and factories during the American Industrial Revolution, like my grandparents did. It was paid for by our government's willingness to provide enormous tax advantages to wealthy corporations and individuals while underfunding social programs that help the poor and the disadvantaged. And this good life was and still is fiercely protected by laws and policies that favor U.S. interests without regard to the seriously negative implications they create for other people, other nations, and other beings that share our planet. Now, it's true that unemployment, runaway health care costs, and mounting government debt are real concerns for our country. However, whatever we do in an effort to create the American good life must be guided by our collective moral conscience, which says that we can no longer focus on achieving our good life while ignoring the basic rights and needs of others. If we're to engage in a way of life that is good not just for ourselves, but for our neighbors near and far, we must begin by thinking about sustainability. A good life that has sustainability at its core means that it's a life built on decisions and actions that contribute to the wholeness and wellness of everyone and everything involved. No one's gain is at another's loss. Everyone wins or no one does. For this reason, says Episcopal theologian Matthew Fox, sustainability is another word for justice. For what is sustainable is just, and what is unjust is not. What does our liberal faith have to say about such an approach to the good life? While a goal of sustainability and justice clearly fits with many of our stated unifying principles, what approach might we take to create a good life that's also a conscientious life? For answers, we might consider the development and application of four life skills or core behaviors as outlined by Unitarian Universalist minister Michael Schuller in his book, Making the Good Life Last. Schuller argues that somewhere between the concept of sustainability and the myriad of concrete applications, persons must adopt a set of behavioral keys which, when properly understood, lay the groundwork for adaptive action. Now, Schuller believes that these four core behaviors are paying attention, staying put, exercising patience, and practicing prudence. Schuller argues that when we're able to put these four keys into practice on a regular basis, our choices will be wiser, healthier, and more considerate. We'll find ourselves guided more and more by decisions that heal our spirit and the wider world. And in this way, we'll also come to know the communal nature of the good life. We'll see the good life as one that energizes our minds, bodies, and spirits, and energetically builds the beloved community that we all dream about. So the first key, paying attention, Schuller says is about deeply noticing things, our lives, our surroundings, the communities in which we live, the infrastructures upon which we depend, the way things truly are. Paying attention. The second key, staying put, is about controlling our restlessness and belonging to what's already present in our lives. It's not about staying stuck in something destructive, says Schuller, but rather about accepting the responsibility of connection and growth that comes with making a commitment to our existing circumstances and our current relationships. Staying put. The third key, exercising patience, is about delaying our gratification and slowing down our pace. It enables us to reflect in a meaningful way on our actions and to develop a deeper appreciation for the world around us. Exercising patience. And the final key, practicing prudence, involves acting with due caution and foresight. Schuller says it means living mindfully, exercising care, and just applying common sense. Practicing prudence. Now, these four keys Reverend Michael Schuller presents may not seem terribly new. However, what I find intriguing about them is that they are, in fact, spiritual practices, simple spiritual practices that sharpen our awareness of ourselves by inviting us to engage more profoundly in the details of our lives and the wider world. So where can we find models for living a life built on these simple spiritual practices? What can we do to develop them in ourselves? And how can these spiritual practices help us create a good life that's both personally satisfying and sustains others? Well, in my own experience, I've been drawn on several occasions to the sustaining life, the good life that I have found in contemplative communities. Now, over the years, I have stayed at monasteries and convents, and I've looked forward to the simplicity that they bring into my life and the opportunity I have to reflect. I like their simple furnishings. I like their simple meals. I've always noticed that in most of these communities, there's a commitment to conserving natural resources. And I also like that they tend to focus their day and center their daily lives on activities that renew the mind, the body, and the spirit. Now, my first encounter with a contemplative community was a visit that I made years ago to an Episcopal monastery in Santa Barbara, California, and it was following a painful divorce, and I was, as you might imagine, looking for healing, looking for some answers. Now, members of this community in Santa Barbara live in a retreat house that's located in the hills high above the Pacific Ocean. They're in a beautiful setting. There's a walled garden there, and there's hiking trails in every direction. I felt like I had picked the perfect spot. And the brothers there lead balanced lives of communal prayer, silence, shared household chores, and they also do service out in the wider community. They regularly host workshops and programs on topics critical to one's spiritual journey and transformation. So it's not an insular community. They're very much engaged in the wider community. And in many ways, these brothers seem to practice Schuller's four keys of paying attention, staying put, exercising patience, and practicing prudence. Many of them have been at the Santa Barbara community for decades, and they're committed to the intimacy and the challenges of community life. Now, when I visited them years ago, I experienced not a dull or isolated environment, but a place of thoughtful and engaged persons, persons who cared for themselves and the world around them. They eagerly and graciously invited me into their community. They talked to me about their spiritual journey and shared details of their own. And they also shared with me stories and what it was like to live in community, the challenges of that as well as the joy of that. They were also very kind, and they forgave my mistakes. Like, for example, when I scaled the garden wall after accidentally locking myself out of the retreat house. Or another time when I forgot that there's a morning code of silence and I sat down at the breakfast table and just chatted away while the brothers were sitting around the table just sort of smiling and nodding at me. But after a week's stay, I can tell you I felt rested, calm, and more aware of myself and others. I was healed by their hospitality, and I was humbled by their service. Thinking back on that time in Santa Barbara, I believe that the brothers got it right. And Robin Leach, well, he's got it all wrong. They, of course, know that the good life's not about champagne wishes and caviar dreams. They've discovered that the good life is both an individual and a communal endeavor. It's an endeavor that has the ability to nourish one's soul and feed the hungry spirit of the wider world. The brothers taught me that simple spiritual practices combined with the accountability of community lead to greater peace and greater awareness. These disciplines open the way to a simpler existence that's both life-affirming and life-giving. As we leave this place today, I invite you to ask yourselves, how do I intend to create a good life that sustains me and is sustainable? A life that's kind to myself and just to others. What spiritual practices will I cultivate to help me along the way? Will they include things like paying attention, staying put, exercising patience, or practicing prudence? Or are there other spiritual practices that I'll make more time for in my life? Whatever your spiritual practices may be, may you find them leading you towards a deeper awareness of yourself and each other. And may we find them helping create the good life, a great life, for ourselves and for all. Amen.